Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. One option to address affordable housing could come in downtowns, redeveloping older buildings with housing options above street level.
I think there's a lot of places in the last 30 years that didn't pay any attention to their older buildings, that realize that they're an asset that we should pay attention to them.
We take a closer look at this effort known as upper floor housing with a pair of experts. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look ahead to what's coming to the Delaware art scene early in 2026, including what the Delaware Contemporary is set to showcase. And Enlighten Me highlights the work of student journalists at the University of Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Happy to be back from our holiday break with a new show for you. We'll start by diving into the housing crisis. Ongoing efforts to address the substantial need for more affordable housing suggest multiple solutions are necessary to build the needed level of available housing stock. One possible approach that could help is something called upper floor housing or upper floor redevelopment projects. They are a way some communities are utilizing underused spaces like empty office buildings or unused historic buildings to meet demands for housing while preserving their downtown facades. Upstairs Downtown is an organization that seeks to help upper floor redevelopers through workshop events like one held last month at the Smyrna Opera House. Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale spent some time with historic preservation architect Mike Jackson and Carmody Consulting's principal consultant Dan Carmody to discuss how Delaware communities could benefit from upper floor redevelopment.
So the first thing I wanted to talk about in general was this idea of the upper story, turning upper stories into residential, et cetera. Can you guys just talk on that? I mean, some folks, I myself included, don't think about this type of thing every day.
Well, we think it's a pretty big deal. For 20 years, we've been sort of on the road telling the story, and America has, you know, hundreds of thousands of towns and cities, particularly of smaller size, with roughly about 50% of the second or third floor space above small buildings is vacant. And many towns have found out that once renovated, those spaces are pretty cool and people really enjoy living up there. And so it helps to drive, you get 150 people living in a small downtown, each spending $10,000 or $15,000 in their neighborhood. It has a positive effect not just on the upper floor, but on the merchants who are trying to make a living downtown.
And largely, it's this growth of population in the communities that addresses a need of what do you do with a vacant building? But we have these half-vacant buildings where we traditionally had a first-floor, ground-floor use that kept up. But the upper floor now we think actually could be more valuable than the first floor as we've seen the decline of retail and online taking over. Shops are leaving, but let's get people living downtown and keeping these buildings occupied and keeping them in use forever, which improves the quality of life in the town, the tax base of the town, and creates more citizens in the town.
And, at the same time we have this vacant space that's an existing resource, we've got something on the order of 3 to 4 million units of housing short in a national housing affordability crisis. So this isn't the answer to that big problem, but it could be part of the answer to that bigger problem.
Rather than tearing a building down, I mean, is there any value to leaving it up?
Sure. The first value is that every time you build a new building, you've got to spend a lot of money on new resources, which takes energy. And by saving a building, you're doing a great resource in carbon avoidance, on climate change avoidance, et cetera, because you don't have to build all that new stuff. You've also got the economic advantage, and then you got the community advantages. So all these come together. The reason we're here is that most small property owners are not conversant in the skill set of economic development and real estate development. So we're here kind of championing all the different real estate development skills that are needed to give small property owners the skill set to help develop and make these properties useful again.
I would just add that many of these buildings are historic gems. They're buildings that we don't build them that way anymore. They really define the soul of our communities, particularly smaller ones. And you tear down that history, you're left with basically a strip mall. And if you want to live there, congratulations, but a lot of people do want to have a place that's kind of unique, and certainly whether it's Smyrna's Main Street or Milford's Main Street, those are distinctive places because of those buildings. And the upper floors, compared to, say, a modern apartment building, typically will have higher ceiling heights, bigger windows, more light, hardwood floors, maybe some ornate wood trim that we don't make anymore. And those features, once highlighted, once polished, once brought back to life, we found that people actually pay a premium to live in that kind of space rather than a traditional new apartment on the edge of town.
Are there challenges to doing this?
If this was easy to do, it would have been done everywhere. But what we recognize for the typical older property owner who has this, real estate development is challenging. There's a lot you need to know, from finance, from development, from the marketing, from the operation,
building
to building costs, zoning ordinances, building codes. So we're trying to hybridize and put all together all these little specialty areas you need to know about, so that people get familiar, know what do they need to know, and maybe who do they need to know it from, so they can start being active with this. And we really try and focus on the civic leadership in the community, local economic development, planning departments, Main Street coordinators, people that can be that conduit to all the owners to build their skill set.
And one of the big barriers is just the fragmented nature we're talking about of a lot of small buildings. And so, you know, much real estate development is done by professional real estate developers, where time is money, and time to do a bigger project, just about as much time to take in to do a smaller project. And so many of these buildings aren't traditionally done by established developers. They're done by people that might have a store on the first floor, that might have a desire to live on the second floor. You know, they're very small, and they're just as complicated as some of the bigger projects, and that's a real barrier.
The skill set of the code enforcement in America has been largely based upon new construction. So the subset of people that specialize in existing buildings is much smaller. And so we're really working on that, how to make buildings safer, but not necessarily get into all the safe level we might get in a brand new building, but definitely safer, definitely better, and typically the way they've always been, by saving those assets of them that are particularly noteworthy.
So what are some ways that the average person like can navigate some of these challenges of this sort of code and the rules? I mean,
I would say the tools that we're offering is that, and tomorrow we're going to specialize in how the building code works, the professionalism that you can use, and there's a new system of numerical safety that gives you points for different types of things you do to make a building safer, because you get a lot of points if you put a sprinkler system, but you can get the same amount of points if you add an extra staircase or add a better fire protection system in terms of alarms. So there's a variety of ways in which you can make buildings safer, and there's a new system that uses a points-based system to do that rather than a specific prescriptive formula.
I do want to ask a little bit more, too, about, you know, the personalities of downtowns, like you mentioned, the strip mall stuff. Are there places that have gone ahead and just sort of, these old buildings, we can't get them safe, it's too much trouble to get people to stay in them, so we're just going to tear them down?
I can't think of a place that has decided that's public policy. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of places in the last 30 years that didn't pay any attention to their older buildings, that realized that they're an asset that we should pay attention to them. So I think the local trend across the country has been the opposite, that people are putting higher value in older buildings, but that doesn't make them any less challenging to solve.
And I know during your presentation, Mike, you gave some specific examples. Can you give us some examples now as well of some places that have utilized this type of model and seen success?
Hastings, Nebraska, and Quincy, Illinois, both of which have had extensive expertise in remodeling dozens of their buildings downtown in relatively small towns through small incremental improvements with their locals. So that's just two examples, but there's hundreds more across the country. There's more than 1,500 Main Street America communities across the U.S. And those are communities with active downtowns that are promoted with a professional organization that's responsible for telling the story of why their downtown is great and promoting its activities, preservation, and utility to the community.
So we've been doing this since 2005, and I can tell you from firsthand experience that towns I've worked in extensively in Iowa, Kansas, Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, have been implementing some forms of the things we're talking about in some fashion.
Is there anything specific about this particular opera house that you guys see that's like stands out?
I haven't gotten into the weeds on the particular facility, but
I think every community has a sense of its destination place, the center of town, downtown, as being a place that's part of its core identity. We see more and more commercial historic districts and community centers.
I mean, just the number of plaques around the building about who donated what. Obviously, this place resonated with residents here. They wanted to support its renovation.
More of a future-facing question. Is this practice of this sort of upper-level residency of living above these other places and filling these sort of vacant areas, is this something that you would hope would gain even more traction?
Well, it's gaining more traction because, as it turns out, because we're so good at ordering things from Amazon, that the demand for space on the upper floors is actually getting stronger as the demand for retail space on the ground floor continues to weaken. So we just heard from one developer this week, they lost their two retail tenants. The only reason they haven't had really strong financial problems is the four apartments upstairs are just churning along. So I think you'll see more of that until we, I don't see a reversal of the trend that storefront retail is really difficult with all of the business we choose to do. And I'm not throwing stones. I've ordered my Amazon gifts to get here before Christmas, just like everybody else. But that is a fact of older downtown Main Street communities is the upper floor demand is actually becoming stronger as the first floor demand for space becomes weaker.
And we want to make vital communities that have lots of people living in them the safest place.
Yeah.
It's safer to live where there's lots of other people living when you've got this attitude of downtown is everybody's place.
And if you have one apartment and somebody opens a coffee shop, it's no big deal. But over the course of 10 years, you build 100, 125 units, all of a sudden, you got a much more successful coffee shop.
Thanks to historic preservation architect Mike Jackson, Carmody Consulting principal consultant Dan Carmody, and our Israel Hale for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny joins us for a look ahead to some of the things to watch for on the art scene here in 2026. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As we head into 2026, we here at The Green remain committed to putting a strong focus on the Delaware arts community through our regular arts segment, Arts Playlist. The segment is helmed by our local Morning Edition host, Martin Matheny. And we figured as we launch into 2026, it would be a good time to chat with Martin about some of the people and places he's got an eye on over the next few months. And let's start with the Delaware Symphony Orchestra, which has a new face of the organization as it starts 2026. Tell us a little bit about who that is and what she brings to DSO on the music side first.
Yeah, well, Michelle DeRusso is the new music director, new conductor of the orchestra after a lengthy search that ended up coming down to four finalists that each spent a week with the orchestra, each conducted a concert with the orchestra, and she was the choice. And I think she's a great choice, actually, because she brings, first of all, a really wonderful presence on the podium. I mean, there's no denying she is a fantastic conductor. One thing that I like about Michelle DeRusso's approach is what she brings in terms of repertoire and sort of her musical aesthetic, because she's got a devotion to the masterworks, but she's also got a real passion for highlighting living composers and sort of presenting this notion that a lot of classical music listeners wish were more widespread, which is that classical music is a living, growing, evolving art form. So if you take a look at sort of the rest of their season in 2026, the rest of this season that's going on right now, January 30th, they're at the Grand for a performance called Waltzing Through Winter, and that's going to be a lot of your traditional masterworks, the big Tchaikovsky violin concerto, Strauss, Rosenkavalier, Richard Strauss, not Johann, Ravel's La Valse, and then so three kind of very traditional warhorse masterworks, and then you've got a piece by a living composer, Anna Klein, called Masquerade, written in 2013 for the BBC Proms. So a really interesting mix of music there. Then in March, they're back at the Grand for sci-fi, television, and movie themes called Across the Galaxy is the concert. You'll hear stuff from Star Trek and Star Wars and Doctor Who. And then they're going to close out this season with a concert at the Grand. And then 2 days later at Cape Henlopen High School. So that's another thing. I love that they're going on the road. That concert, Flames of Renewal. So another work by a living American composer, Carlos Simon's Four Black American Dances, which was written less than 3 years ago. And then Gershwin's Piano Concerto in F and Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. So the oldest piece of music on this final concert is just a little over a century old, which is last week in classical music terms.
And you mentioned they're going on the road and heading downstate to Cape Henlopen High School. And that's an indication, I think, that it's not just the music per se that she's focused on. She also seems to have a desire to build connections and reach out to the broader community. What has she told you about the efforts she's making in this area?
Yeah, I've talked to Michelle twice since she was officially named the music director for the orchestra. And this is something that always comes up. And here's something that she said to me when we spoke last fall.
We're talking about ideas of things we would like to do, but I came with ideas of doing, you know, pop-up concerts in different areas. So it could be like in a farmer's market, or maybe there's a festival happening. I think that people need to see us. We need to go to them too. I also think it is important to provide different kinds of experiences and not just masterworks.
So you can see this is something that is really important to her. I think it's something that is incredibly important to the future sustainability of orchestras, whether they're in Delaware or anywhere else in the world. You've got to bring music to the people where they are and start pulling down some of these barriers between audience and orchestra. And that's something that she's very passionate about and something that I think you're going to see in the years to come too.
Certainly a way to build new audiences.
Absolutely.
So let's move over to the First State Ballet. What is first up for them in 2026?
They've got a great performance coming up in February at the Baby Grand, and I am here. This is my ride or die. I am standing up for contemporary ballet. It is awesome, and that's what this performance is. It's called Dreams in Motion, and you're reuniting the ballet with a frequent collaborator, Viktor Plotnikov, and if your ballet experience is things like Cinderella, Swan Lake, Nutcracker, this is something that is not better, not worse, but very different when you're talking about contemporary ballet. It's two works. One is a fantasy to Dvorak, and the other is called Nonsense in the Sense of Innocence, which is a title that I love. Both of these ballets are going to tend a little bit more surrealistic, and you're going to see some really dynamic, really action-oriented motion and choreography and some really colorful, cool costumes as well.
And the venue's worth noting, the Baby Grand. How does that change the experience for an audience, particularly maybe someone who's new to ballet?
Yeah, one thing that First State Ballet does a couple of times a year is they go into a smaller space and they do it on purpose. So you don't have this massive gap between audience and performer. And so they're going to be at the Baby Grand for Dreams in Motion. And it's a more intimate experience. You're part of a smaller audience and you're closer to the dancers. And you can really kind of admire not just sort of the macro version of what they're doing, but the technical expertise that goes into contemporary dance.
It's really, really interesting. How about Opera Delaware? It opens 2026 with a pair of shows right here in January. One is kind of an opera staple. So let's start with that one. What are we expecting there?
Yeah. So Pagliacci, everybody knows it. And, you know, it's sort of your prototypical Italian opera about a love triangle and betrayal and tragedy, and it's great, and there's a reason why it's one of the most famous operas in the world. What they've done that's really interesting is they're pairing this with an opera that was written, gosh, just about 10 years ago called Service Provider. And that opera is also about a love triangle, just in a little bit more of a comedic way. And what's interesting to me about Service Provider, and I can't wait to see this performed, is that one of the main characters in this opera is the humble cell phone. And I spoke to the opera's Carianne Ottagno, and she gave me kind of a nice description of what this opera is about.
Let's take a listen.
One of the characters is just the sound of ringtones, because that's how they end up getting caught. It's a married couple out at a restaurant for their anniversary, and the husband's mistress shows up, and text messages are going, and you're hearing the different ringtones and stuff. So that is a character in the show.
So it's a really amazing, interesting, timely concept. And by the way, the opera Service Provider is sung in English. So two kind of one-act operas, similar but different in scope and very different in tone, with kind of the same narrative backbone in a lot of ways.
But that second one being a comedy, being a little bit more modern, again, goes back to this issue of accessibility, right? That, mm-hmm. that they're trying to maybe connect with audiences that might not be traditional opera audiences.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that Carianne Ottagno from the opera mentioned to me is both of these operas, they go really well on the road. Mm-hmm. So this is something that, you know, they're looking forward to maybe in the future being able to perform one or both of these operas, not necessarily at their studios in Wilmington where this concert is, but say at a brewery or, you know, a kind of similar community location. So again, taking the music where the people are.
So let's wrap up with the Delaware Art Museum. They have an exhibition that you highlighted recently that focuses on race and identity in the world of illustration. And that field's a pretty expansive one, so it's going to hit on a lot of things that people are familiar with. Can you explain it a little bit to us?
Yeah, this is, to me, a really important show because perhaps more than what we might call traditional fine art, I think you get a picture of how society perceives things and people and groups through popular illustration, through what's in our magazines and in our newspapers and on our cereal boxes, right? So the Delaware Art Museum has put this exhibition together. They did it in conjunction with the Rockwell Museum in Massachusetts. And in fact, it's sort of a trade-off because they're sending that exhibition up to the Rockwell Museum fairly soon. It closes here March 1st. So as I said, I think it's a really important show. It's one where you're going to see some things that ask some tough questions and maybe is a little bit uncomfortable in the way that race is illustrated. A couple of artists that are in this show. One is a very famous Delaware illustrator, Howard Pyle, mm-hmm. and some of the work that he did. And then this one really kind of surprised me, but one of the artists in this show is Norman Rockwell. And when I think about Norman Rockwell, I think about Saturday Evening Post. Mm-hmm. I think about pictures of families and scenes that are incredibly white.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to Heather Campbell Coyle from the museum, and she told me, yeah, that was correct for a while. And then Rockwell had a bit of a sea change. And this is what she said.
By the time you get into the 1950s and 1960s, Rockwell has realized that he wants to portray what he thinks is the most important thing going on in the world, which is the struggle for civil and human rights. And so he is turning his attention in new directions, and he has to find a new place to do that. And he goes and starts doing some work for Look magazine, which was largely a photojournalist magazine. But their primary focus was on current events. He stops working for the Post after 47 years and then begins to work for places that are going to, you know, put out the stories that he's interested in telling.
So Norman Rockwell, a huge artistic evolution, and this is just such a important show that, you know, it's definitely on my list of things for the first few months of this year.
And certainly, just kind of continuing with the through line of our conversation, because it's dealing with things that are often in pop culture, again, very accessible, things that people perhaps are more familiar with, and it doesn't feel like there's that kind of maybe normal gap between public audience and fine art, and, you know, that maybe sometimes people are threatened by.
Yeah, you know, not everybody has an oil painting in their home, but most of us have objects that are illustrated. So this is going to feel familiar, and maybe that sort of opens a door to asking some of the questions or responding to some of the questions that this exhibition asks.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media's Morning Edition and Arts Playlist host, Martin Matheny, for joining us this week. And Martin will be back in just a moment with the first Arts Playlist of 2026, which takes us to the Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington. Stick around for that on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We stay on the art scene for this segment, shifting our focus to the Delaware Contemporary. It is closed to the public right now, but inside, museum curators and other staff are working hard to prepare a trio of new exhibitions designed to spark deep conversations and introspection. To find out what's coming to the Delaware Contemporary, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny spoke to its Director of Communications, Design, and Strategy, Siobhan Taylor, for this week's Arts Playlist.
Let me start by asking you to tell me a little bit about the Delaware Contemporary, the mission, and the different spaces that it has for art.
Absolutely. And so one, I'll start out by saying the Delaware Contemporary is now under new leadership. Our new executive director, Britt John Johnson, joined us in spring of last year. And so we're really excited to have him follow Leslie Schaefer, who left us last year. And so as always, the Delaware Contemporary, which is the only contemporary art space here in the region, is always consistently dedicated to infusing contemporary art and creativity into our community through compelling exhibitions, dynamic educational experiences, and access to the artistic process. And we present exhibitions of regionally, nationally, internationally recognized artists that are really exploring the topical issues in contemporary art today. And that we additionally provide opportunities for local and emerging artists to showcase their work and advance their artistic growth through workshops, through our artists in residencies program. And so we're really excited to continue that mission.
You've got three new exhibitions opening on January 16th, and I'm going to take you through them one by one to find out more. And let's start with Creative Influencer. And I was looking at the website to get prepared for our talk, and the image connected to that exhibition, so much red, so vibrant, so compelling. Tell me a little bit about the exhibition and what people can expect to see.
Absolutely. So Creative Influencer, which will be in Gallery 3, is curated by our assistant curator, Katia Bunofsky. And so she is really exploring what it means for this current moment of creative influencers to make their way into contemporary art, how their practices online have led into contemporary art. And so there are two artists that will be featured there, is Lindsay Sherrick, and her work really captures everyday objects that function like culture scapes, capturing queer life in real time. A lot of their work is focused on creating a kind of blueprint for a community-focused world that they like to live in. And so Lindsay and her work is often talking about how their work centers pleasure and joy beyond capitalism, because systems like capitalism are deeply reliable on hyper-individualism, isolation, and, you know, very binary ideas like gender. And so in addition to Lindsay, Perry Picasso, who is also identified as she, they, is a first generation Mexican-American artist who really believes that art should be more than something you look at, and it should be something that you look in. And so both of these, you know, artists are entering the museum, one for the first time as actual fine artists. And so one, I think it really makes way for us to have a conversation, you know, about how we are looking at contemporary art now that we have all kind of lived in this digital world for so long, and that beyond displaying art on digital platforms, how are artists also taking their digital practices and turning them into contemporary art? So really excited to see how Lindsay and Perry both bring that particular lens to this exhibition and how Kasia's curatorial voice helps shape that.
Another exhibition opening on the 16th is entitled This Place Meant. Again, just a really compelling image associated with that I saw. It felt almost surrealistic, almost kind of Dali-esque in a way. Tell me about what's on display there.
Sure. So This placement, which will be in Gallery 2 here at the museum, is curated by our newly appointed Gretchen Helpful Curator of Contemporary Art, Dr. Morgan Hamilton, features three artists, Rayanne, Shira, and Sia. And so all of these pieces, and I believe that you might be referring to Rayanne's work, who in 2020, she transferred from a more traditional practice to an alternative one that is fostering a more, one equitable and creative approach to design. And her pieces are really inviting viewers to step into these imagined spaces and challenge us to reflect on our personal attitudes toward futurism, futurist aesthetics, while reminding us that our, envisioned future built environments can honor our heritages, our communities, our shared joys. Shira, who is also in that exhibition, her work is deeply focused on people and places in the city of Philadelphia. And so her work is really, working and thinking about innovative projects to elevate the resilience of immigrant and refugee stories. And then lastly, in that exhibition is Sia, who is a Palestinian American artist whose work is deeply thinking about personal and collective narratives of loss, of exile, of resistance, even as those communities are figuring out how to celebrate beauty and joy around them. She grew up in the Middle East, and so these color, quality of light, traces of millennia of human presence really continue to resonate through her work, even as the landscapes of Northern U.S., where she has lived her adult life, really influence, what she paints. And so deeply thinking about place and how you have a new lens of folks who have either immigrated or, transitioned here to the U.S. and are thinking about what it means to belong to the place that they are living in.
And then speaking kind of belonging, there's also Constellation of Belonging is being opened as well on January 16th.
Absolutely. So Constellations of Belonging is actually curated by me. And so I am really excited to bring Deborah Cartwright and Tiana McMillan here to the Contemporary to think about and what is unfolding as a social and political moment shaped by this intensified surveillance, bodily regulation, and this really increasing demand that lived experiences, particularly that of Black women, are, rendered visible, legible, and consumable. And so in this climate, the body, is frequently treated as evidence, right? Something that is monitored, narrated, disciplined, and really asked to justify its own existence. And so here I'm inviting Deborah and Tiana to not clarify the body's meaning, but instead attend to how two artists remain with themselves under the conditions and the ways that they negotiate presence without having to surrender their interiority. And so Deborah Cartwright is an artist who's deeply interested in depicting the relationship between the Black female body and American medical history. I'm really excited to have her join after being at Art Basel and London Frieze, and Tiana McMillan, who is a ceramicist and a curator who is also thinking about fragmentation of the Black female body. And so really excited to bring the two of them to consider belonging as something made and unmade in relation to something that is really shaped by pressure and sustained through imagination.
You know, we have these exhibitions that are opening on January 16th, but that's really, in terms of what the Delaware Contemporary does, it's really just part of the story. What else do you do to help artists, especially in the community around you?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. And so I think there are a couple ways that, we have and are, continuing to think through our reach beyond the galleries. And so I'd say one, running for its fifth or sixth consecutive year, is the Artist in Residence program here at the Delaware Contemporary, where we select four emerging artists to join us for the year. And they have access to free studio space, a mentor, and then also engage in a culminating exhibition here in the museum. So that is something that is always exciting for us to continue. Our studios at Artist Community, which is our on-site studios, home to currently 28 working artists, whose practices really span painting and sculpture, photography. And these artists really do bring a daily energy to the building through hosting open studios. They also collaborate on exhibitions and really help shape, I think, the overall creative culture. We also have our Art Source Registry, which is our regional kind of search engine for discovering and connecting artists. And so artists who are within a 250-mile radius of Wilmington have the ability to upload their portfolios and artist statements and biographies that really make them visible to a number of curators and galleries. I think currently we are, a little over 400 registered artists there on that registry. And then, you know, we also host a number of community programs with our nonprofit community partners, host a number of public programs and events with our community members, and also have our educational programming as well, where we bring students in from places like Avengrove and have gone into schools like Kumba and Freire, and we use our either community artists or studio artists to spend time with the students there to really reflect on what is contemporary art, right? Which is something that I think we're always battling up against and having a conversation about meaning, and then, you know, how to engage with it at every level, so that a 4-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 40-year-old, and a 104-year-old can also really understand what it means to engage with contemporary art.
Thanks to Delaware Contemporary's Director of Communications Design and Strategy, Siobhan Taylor, and Darren Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Delaware Contemporary's new exhibitions open Friday, January 15th. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a trip to the University of Delaware to check out stories by student journalists there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we visit the University of Delaware to highlight work from student journalists. Pieces produced by UD Communications students for a fall semester class taught by Lydia Timmons. We start with Erica Chang, who examines the impact of federal cuts on food safety in the United States.
After major federal workforce cuts this year and even more reductions proposed for the upcoming year, food safety oversight is shifting across the country. Recalls have been issued for a variety of reports ranging from shredded cheese contaminated with metal shards and baby formula linked with botulism. But behind those headlines lies a bigger story, a shrinking federal workplace responsible for catching these problems before the products hit the shelves. This past spring, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the agency that oversees the Food and Drug Administration, cut about 10,000 positions nationwide, including specialists involved in monitoring food safety. Shortly after, Reuters reported the FDA suspended several food safety quality checks due to a lack of staff to run them. This suspension raised red flags for food development professionals like Connie Gregson, VP of Research and Development at Happy Coffee. Gregson stated that testing food stability is incredibly sensitive.
With food products, our job is to make sure that the products are first and foremost safe to drink. So anything that has to sit on the shelf, we have to make sure that it's stable from a microbiology standpoint, so it's not going to spoil.
Gregson added that new recipes, packaging, and manufacturing are where mistakes most likely occur.
The most vulnerable time is if you're working on a new product, like a completely new base, and you haven't tested it. So if you don't understand the stability of that.
And when problems do happen, companies, not the government, are doing most of the work.
Recall is all voluntary. But the fact of the matter is that FDA, like, there are limited resources, so they don't really have ways to police recalls. So it falls on the industry or the company. And sometimes, like, if it's a smaller company, then they might not be making the right choices as far as, like, pulling things off the shelf because they don't want to lose money. They don't want to lose distribution. So it is risky not having, like, that policing mechanism.
With decreasing federal oversight, the administration has proposed additional FDA and HHS workforce cuts for 2026. College student Abby Bevan is among the concerned consumers.
I am concerned about the food recalls because I am a college student and I don't have, like, extra time to be looking at the recalls, like, on the news. I would like to be healthy, and the food recalls would not help that.
Beyond customers, workers in food service are also feeling the pressure. Cafe worker Sarah Hsu says that customer anxiety is already climbing.
And as customers, very often, our concerns regarding, like, where we're getting our ingredients from, and more complaints regarding that as well. And that could definitely cause more stress for me and my boss.
While it's too early to know what impacts the additional proposed cuts for next year might mean, less staffing, fewer inspections, and suspended lab checks raise questions of whether the system meant to prevent unsafe food from reaching the people is slowly being weakened.
Thanks to Erica Chang for her reporting. Next up is Rachel Santora and her piece on the growing interest in distance running and what's driving that interest.
If you scroll TikTok lately, it feels like everyone is suddenly training for a marathon or signing up for a triathlon or entering their so-called running era. But what's actually behind this new wave of long-distance racing? Across the country, race organizers are reporting record signups, especially among people in their late teens and 20s. And many say it all starts right here on social media, where daily run logs, race day vlogs, and motivational clips are inspiring beginners to lace up. I talked to Emma Robinson, who recently started training after seeing the trend online.
I've always worked out and been active, but I think social media definitely influenced me to start doing races like triathlons and marathons. I saw people my age getting to travel the world doing them, and I really wanted something to train for that would bring me places as well. But training for them has been such a good experience so far. It's great motivation, and I do definitely think that everyone should do one, even if it's small.
For a lot of young people, running isn't just about fitness. It becomes a lifestyle. There's the routine, the discipline, and the community that comes with race training. And for many, it's also a mental health boost during a time when stress, school, and social pressure feels constant. I also spoke with Grant Michaels, a seasoned triathlon competitor and a longtime CrossFit athlete. He's been training most of his life and lives an extremely disciplined, healthy lifestyle. He told me he sees both the positives in this new wave of endurance racing and the pressures it can create for beginners.
Do I think there's pressure to run because of social media? Yeah, I definitely think social media can put a lot of pressure on people in different ways, especially with how popular running has gotten in the past couple years with all the fitness influencers. But I think people only feel that pressure if they're not already satisfied with what their life looks like and the achievements. I think pressure is just your body telling you, you know, something has to change and it wants more for itself.
Experts say part of the appeal is accessibility. Why fall into an unhealthy lifestyle when most people have the full ability to do the right thing? They argue that taking care of your body doesn't require fancy equipment or a strict program, just consistency and the willingness to show up every day.
I've been influenced for so long to go out to the bars or go drink and do unhealthy things. Why not do the other thing and do something that's healthy for my body?
Whether people are searching for a challenge, a community, or just a new identity to step into, one thing is clear. Running culture is having a moment, and for many young adults, crossing that finish line, whether it's 13 miles, 26 miles, or an entire triathlon, this has become the newest badge of an accomplishment.
Thanks to Rachel Santora for her piece. And we close with Ellie Hintz, who explains how one local venue is putting the spotlight on UD student music acts.
Ooh. On a Friday night at the University of Delaware, Deer Park Tavern has its usual glow, neon signs, crowded booths, and students packed around the tables. But in the last year, something new has been happening here. Live music, and especially student music, has exploded. And for Deer Park, that shift didn't happen by accident.
I like to have things that are rooted in Deer Park's history still be a part of Deer Park today here in 2025, and that's live music.
That's Morgan Minner, Director of Special Events, Marketing, and Social Media for Ashby Hospitality Group. She books all the live acts that come through Deer Park, and she's watched a trend grow faster than anyone expected.
Turns out students really love to see their peers on stage, whether it's DJ acts or bands. So I really found my niche with bringing in student-based music, and the kids really responded well to that.
And that's where Fools in the Sun comes in, a band made up entirely of UD students. For the past year, all six members have been playing at day parties in the backyard of fraternity houses. But for the first time, they got to step onto a real venue stage under real lights. Dylan Noe, the band's lead singer, talks about what it's like to perform for their peers.
It's just something fresh. It's something new. It's a lot more engaging than being at a party with a single live DJ. And although that's like obviously a skill set in of itself, it's less natural. It's a lot more artificial. And I think the students like seeing students that are their age that are showcasing their talents and putting work in to try to make people united and happy.
For Dylan and the rest of the band, playing in a venue like Deer Park isn't just exciting. It's a milestone. Morgan says it's the kind of experience that builds confidence for student bands.
Our show for Fools in the Sun on the 17th was the first time they've played in a venue, and you know, and not in a frat backyard or a basement.
Morgan keeps a close eye on the student music scene. She scouts bands online, follows them on social media, and tries to give them opportunities to perform at Deer Park.
They're all UD students, so I like to keep that pathway open for student-based bands, and that's how I got in contact with Fools in the Sun.
The audience shows up every time. Watching peers on stage brings a different kind of energy to the room.
They connect with it because these are their peers, and it is fun to see your friends up on stage and out on a marquee and with signage through the restaurant. Fools in the Sun loved that.
Looking to the future, Dylan shared what he hopes comes next for student music in Newark.
Hopefully, like, there will be other bands after us, like after we leave the Newark area. Hopefully students are inspired to start their own music and continue the live music genre here.
And that's what's happening with live music on campuses. I'm Ellie Hintz, and thank you for listening.
Thanks to Ellie Hintz, as well as fellow University of Delaware students Erica Chang and Rachel Santura, for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for a weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. University of Delaware student journalists Erica Chang, Ellie Hintz, and Rachel Santora, as well as Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.